Okay, we're back to questions from the floor. Yes, sir, in the purple.
Why, with the advent of all the different regulations that seem to be going on within the banking industry, do you think it would be a good point for some sort of a bank to come up and to their customers out front and say, look, we're going to stick with 100% reserve system. Is there a niche market for this now with all of the craziness that seems to be going on?
Anybody?
Okay.
Yeah, I don't want to hurt book sales, though, by giving away the answer. a couple things. So one thing that's a little bit strange is technically right now the banks have more than 100% reserves, which is sort of weird just because the Fed has inflated so much and pumped in so many reserves and the banks aren't making new loans. So that's sort of odd. More generally, it's not the case, and maybe Walter or somebody wants to jump in when I say this, it's not the case that right now the government's forcing you to have fractional reserves. It's that through the various cartelization techniques, the penalties that hit a bank from having fractional reserves get mitigated, right? So if there's a bank run right now, you know, the FDIC makes it less likely there's going to be a bank run, and then the lender of last resort, you know, the Fed can sort of inject liquidity around the country if a certain area has fewer reserves. So it's not so much that before the problems of fractional reserve weren't there and now they are there. It's more that the Fed was making it harder for them to stay in business. So what was happening is the reason the competitive outcome thus far has been no bank stays in business with 100% reserves is that it can't pay as much. You know, it would have to charge you for a checking account, whereas its competitors don't, or they could even offer interest because they're allowed to stay in business where they would probably go out of business under a free market. So anyway, all that having been said, I think it's not so much that there'd be a new bank that would have 100% reserves. I think it would be more a bank or a system that's not tied to the dollar would be the thing I would say would happen as a result of people really being uncertain.
I think one difficulty with it, and I could be wrong about this, but in the 19th century, the controversy was, what is the nature of the transaction when I deposit money somewhere? Am I depositing money the same way I would deposit grain in a warehouse or deposit furniture in a warehouse? Or am I, in fact, in some way relinquishing my control over this? I mean, so in other words, is it a bailment? Am I storing this, you know, in an envelope with my name on it for safekeeping? Or am I, in fact, sort of lending it to the institution? And now, the older view was precisely that the bank was a money warehouse, and that would be the 100% reserve view. And so, but the problem is that the law has now come to recognize the nature of this transaction differently, so that it does not view it as being analogous to storing a chair that you have immediate claim to on demand at any time. So my concern would be that if a bank announced that it's engaging in a 100% reserve policy, even if it wanted to do this, I'm not sure the depositor would have an enforceable claim against this bank because the legal system does not, in fact, view the banking system in that way. Does not? You follow my argument? Do you think I'm right about that?
Yeah. Even beyond that, it's conceivable that various regulatory agencies would forbid a bank from engaging in this practice and advertising itself as a safer and sounder type of bank because that might cast suspicion on other banks. To give you an example of this, an analogy, a few years ago there was a beef processing plant in Nebraska that specialized in producing a particular type of very high-end beef for export to Japan. And the Japanese market required very strict standards. So this meatpacking facility began inspecting the beef, having additional inspections and certification beyond that required by government regulation. The USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, shut them down. The U.S. Department of Agriculture ruled, forbade them from having additional inspections beyond USDA certification to its product precisely because this might mislead consumers into thinking that the government's own inspection standards were inadequate. And they actually sued, this company sued and lost in federal court. The court ruled in favor of the USDA that they could not inspect their beef, you know, a second time. Yeah, I think kosher food is different, I guess, because there's a religious exemption. But certainly the Fed and various bank regulatory agencies would not be very happy about this. And, of course, we saw this with the TARP program, that when the TARP, when the Treasury Department was giving these additional loans, was the special injections, buying assets, troubled assets from particular banks, banks that did not receive TARP money were forbidden from advertising the fact that they did not get TARP money. The Treasury did not want it revealed which banks got TARP money and which ones didn't, because that might make customers think that some banks were safer or sounder than others.
Let me just point out, isn't it funny? Of course, this is true of any cartel. I didn't realize until just a few years ago that lawyers, that a law firm can have a commercial and say how wonderful they are, but then it also has to say, sort of, you know, in small print or something, that, by the way, this does not mean we're any better than any other law firm. Like, they're all required to say that we are not necessarily any better, but we're really awesome. Like, they all have to say that.
I mean, depending on who you ask, some banks claim that they were compelled to take the TARP money, but some others have said that's just, they're just saying that they really were happy to have it. I don't know.
I can remember in one of the previous lectures, they were talking about how Austrians over the years, some have shied away from using the term capitalist or capitalism just because of how it could be misconstrued. And I thought to myself, fair enough. But then I thought, what about anarcho-capitalism? Right? And I thought, and my question to you is, you know, sometimes when someone asks me what I believe, you know, I'm afraid that they're going to think I'm some guy at the G20 summits, like throwing rocks at somebody. So my question is, have you guys ever considered maybe a name change? And if so, what else can you call it?
No, this subject has never come up.
The official committee, the Bilderberger Austrian Libertarian Committee, is having its meeting later today to discuss what the official name will be.
I got into a cat and dog fight with Sheldon Richman over this. I was saying, you know, we should use capitalism, and he was saying, well, capitalism is, you know, a dirty word for many people. And my view is the more words we have, the better to describe us, and our enemies want to keep taking words away from us. They took liberal away from us. They're even trying to take libertarian away from us. I mean, at this rate, we won't be able to call ourselves anything. So I see nothing wrong with saying anarcho-capitalism or free market capitalism or laissez-faire capitalism, and also saying, yes, there is such a thing as corporate monopoly state capitalism, but that's fascism and that's not us. The word capitalism first came about from the Marxists, and they meant it not as a compliment. So we're taking that word that was used to denigrate us and, you know, being out front and up there. And it's sort of like with black people, with the N-word, N as a Nathan, right? They were called this originally, and it was a slur. And yet they take it upon themselves to call each other that as a mark of approval. So in a similar way, I think we should keep the word capitalism. Sheldon takes the other view, and this debate is on the LouRockwell.com somewhere, so if you're interested, you could look it up.
But I mean, it's just a pragmatic question. It might also depend on who you're talking to. For some particular audiences, one word might make more sense. It's just a question of clear communication. I don't think there's any one official term that should universally be used or not. It's like the term Austrian. People always say, well, the term Austrian school, it's confusing, it's backward-looking. What does this have to do with Austria, except historically, you know? You could tell your story about the guy you were debating, some insurance guy. You know, I don't have any particular commitment to the word Austrian. I use it because I've never heard a better word that communicates more effectively what this school of thought is. Other people want to come up with different words, you know, spontaneous order economics or coordination economics or whatever. I mean, okay, that's fine. If you want to try, if people want to use that, okay, but I don't find that to be particularly more effective just as a practical matter than Austrian.
Yeah, but I understand the question you're asking, because I think the question is more about the anarcho than the capitalism. And it, So what do you believe? And like people ask, like, I don't really know what to say to them that isn't going to completely scandalize them. So I think, well, then what if I just say, well, private property? People hate private property too. So like, what? I don't know. Like, when you live, like, all the things I cherish the most are despised by mankind. So it becomes hard to think of, well, isn't there one little phrase, like, peace? I guess it fundamentally comes down to, I believe in peace. Not just international peace, but interpersonal peace. And then people think I'm wearing sandals and beads. So I don't know. I don't know. We have to keep thinking about it. This is one of these things that if we sat down and had a few drinks, I think the juices would be flowing. Maybe something would come up. But it seems like this question comes up all the time, and we never come up with a really satisfactory answer.
You believe in peace, you're a sissy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, indeed. That's okay. Maybe that's the word. I'm a sissy.
Right. We're
sissitarians. Also, one thing that I don't like, the strategic issue. You talk to some of the people, I'm not saying Sheldon Richmond was saying this, but some of the people who are saying about the capitalism, they're acting as if there's all these hordes of people who are just gung-ho about Rothbardianism, but they, because we call it capitalism, they get turned off. And I don't think that's right. I think if we called it whatever, they, you know, he would say, let's say we're in favor of the freed market instead of the free market. I don't think all of a sudden, you know, the people who watch Overman are going to say, oh, okay, well then we're with you guys. You know, that's, so I mean, so yeah, it's important to make the distinctions, but the way I would do it is just to say, by this way, when we say capitalism, we mean that we don't mean this kind of stuff, as opposed to saying, well, I'm not a capitalist, I'm a, you know, whatever the term he wants to use.
Yes, sir.
Well, the Austrian alternative is a market in money. Generally speaking, where you have a commodity-based money, gold and silver, as you know, the monetary means of circulation. And most Austrians also advocate 100% reserve banking or free banking. But so the money would be based on the cost of, well, I don't want to say the cost of production, but there is natural limits in the marketplace on the amount of money that would be interjected into the system.
Strictly speaking, though, there is no Austrian policy here. You don't advocate gold qua Austrian. You can only advocate that stuff qua libertarian. Austrians are limited to value-free analysis of. An Austrian might say, well, if you have central banking, you're going to get this result, and if you have gold, you'll have that result. But qua Austrian, they can't say, well, and therefore we favor this. Because once they say that, they're no longer speaking as an Austrian. This is a very important point to make. We made this in the last session, but I guess there's a new crew here, so it's worthwhile repeating. Austrianism is a value-free attempt to understand and analyze reality, period. Libertarianism or liberalism or communism or other isms, political philosophies, are value-laden, and they say, well, the best way to do is to raise the minimum wage or lower the minimum wage. Whereas qua economists, we can say, well, if you raise the minimum wage, thus and such will happen. But, you know, you could be an Austrian Nazi and say, yes, I hate unskilled workers. And as an Austrian, I know that if we have a real high minimum wage, we'll all be unemployed. Rah, rah. Right? So I'm an Austrian, and I favor the minimum wage because I hate unskilled workers. It's a coherent philosophy. It's not a libertarian philosophy, but it's a coherent philosophy.
All too true, but at the same time, obviously, as Walter knows, we all know, there are certain implications that Austrian theory has. For example, the Austrian school can tell me what the consequences of central banking are. Therefore, if I see these consequences are bad, then I think I begin to think about alternatives as a qua human being, right? So I begin to think about alternatives. And so this question comes up a lot. Well, what would you substitute the Fed with? Or that's not a good way of phrasing it, but like what would then supply the money? It's not immediately obvious to people how this would work, because it's obvious to me how a free market in bird cages might work or a free market in shoes, but a free market in the money that I use to buy the bird cages with, this is not obvious. So what I want to recommend is of course, everybody should read What Has Government Done to Our Money? But if you've read that and basically understood it, then the next thing to do is, I think, not to read Theory of Money and Credit, which should be like the way down on your list. Not that it's a bad book, but you've got to be ready for this thing. And it's long. But this, I think, unjustly neglected but really great contribution by Guido Hulsman, his book The Ethics of Money Production. Now, it's sort of a misleading title because you get the sense that it's all going to be moral questions. But it's shot through with exactly how money ought to work. That's how he analyzes the ethics of it, how it ought to work, and therefore why it's wrong when it doesn't work this way. He actually does look at the practical questions involved. And incidentally, that manuscript initially was intended for a kind of religious free market institute. So there are a lot of religious references in there. And I think Guido probably should have mentioned in the foreword, this is why there are all these religious references. It was originally written for a religious institute. So there's a lot of biblical references and so on. But basically, this is a really good systematic overview from the ground up of where money comes from, how it's created, how it works on a free market, and all the various ways that governments have interfered with it and what the consequences of those are. A really indispensable work.
We do provide certificates of attendance at the current point.
Yeah. Also, for the online academy, we do give certificates, and there is – I don't want to misspeak. I don't want to mislead. I don't remember exactly what the policy is, but there is some way that we're going to denote like what grade you got in some – like whether you got an A or B. I think that's the level of precision they're going to go through. So there, again, right now, it doesn't mean a big deal except for, you know, the 1% of the population that loves the Mises Institute. But you're right. It's true going forward. Some people – the way I'm picturing it would be if a college professor somewhere loves the Mises Institute and then there's a high school kid that comes in that can say, look, I got A pluses in all of, you know, Murphy and Klein's classes for the last 3 years. Maybe that professor then is going to, you know, let this kid test out of micro or something. I mean, that's the kind of thing I could see happening first, and then maybe employers even would take notice.
In a like anarcho-capitalist society, kind of like the one you described in your the privatization defense, what would happen on this specific cases where, you know, the state is actually, you know, or currently the state is the advocate? And I guess specifically what I mean is, like, you know, you described somebody took my TV, so I said, hey, somebody took my TV, but like instances of like child abuse where the child, you know, is really unable to sort of like advocate for themselves, you know, whether out of fear or just out of inability to say this is what happened to me.
All right, for me, this is the single hardest thing, and when you're trying to talk about private law, is what do you do about like infants? Because there, all the rules break down. That it's normally you want to talk about, you know, things are consensual, whatever, people have individual rights, but it's really tricky with infants that are utterly helpless. And it's so I'm just going to say I have trouble with a standard. It seems weird to say, well, no, there's this infant sitting in the high chair there, and hey, if he doesn't want to feed himself, tough luck, you know? So anyway, I'm just going to pass the mic and see if these guys can say something else.
Murray,
you talk about that, anarcho-capitalism, you have to compare it to the real alternative. You don't compare it to utopia. That's the Nirvana fallacy. Compare it to what we got now. You know, compare it to like violence in the American West, which is supposedly, you know, anarcho-capitalist violence, to you know, what the state did in the 20th century, killing hundreds of millions of its own people. And read the book Devil's Side by R.J. Rummel, for example. So compare that. So I wonder, public schools are child abuse factories, especially in the inner cities of America. They abuse the minds of children a lot.
I agree with Tom. Certainly, the government creates more crime than anything. I mean, look at the result of the drug war. I mean, half the people in prison are in prison for the victimless crime of putting stuff in their bodies that the government doesn't think they should. Murray Rothbard had this thing called Friends of Bums. The question was, well, suppose some bum gets molested or hurt or whatever, who's going to protect him? One answer is that there would be groups, the charitable groups that would come to his aid. Another would be everything, all property would be private. So the bum, not the child, I'll get to the child in a second, but there is an analogy between the homeless bum who's helpless in a different way than the child. The bum has to be molested on some private property. And presumably the owner of the private property, the street, the park, whatever it is going to take exception to anyone being molested or hurt, so they would come to their rescue. So in other words, the cops, instead of molesting people for victimless crimes like prostitution, pornography, drugs, whatever, the private police would be able to protect people. You're very safe in Disney World or Disneyland or in a mall, because if something bad or untoward happens there, those people lose money. Whereas on the street or in the public park, it doesn't work quite that way. And in Disney World, if you act obstreperously, you'll be surrounded by ducks and geese and mice, and they'll all be packing heat. And they'll come over and they'll say, "Step over here, sir." And if you don't, they'll grab you harshly. So you're pretty safe. Now, with regard to child abuse, the police, instead of watching out for victimless crimes, would have more time to stop that too. And there are cases. There are horrible cases of people who abuse children. And those people, presumably, there'd be fewer of them, not none. We're on the wrong side of the Garden of Eden for perfection. But the free enterprise system, as Bob would say, and as Tom was saying, it's a comparative thing. We'd be better off. Not perfect, but better off.
Let me say one thing. The difficulty is, and everything these guys are saying is true, and it's right. If you don't just take it for granted that, oh, well, that's why we have child protective services. I mean, there are absolute horror stories of just people who have like 12 foster kids in their house, and they're like, you know, having houses of prostitution with them and everything, and the state knows about it for 2 years and doesn't crack down on it. I mean, it's like horrifying things that you wouldn't make up and attribute to them, because you'd think that, come on, it can't be that bad. It is that bad. So that's one answer. But to try to grapple with it more theoretically, like, what would a private judge do? The problem is, like, so if there's a guy who's beating his wife and she's 30 years old and she doesn't want to press charges, I think, you know, standard libertarian theory says, okay, well, she can do that if she wants, and the police can't, or the organization can't enforce her rights for her if she says, you know, no, we want to work it out. But what if there's, you know, the 4-year-old that gets harsh corporal punishment, and the parents say, this is the way I view things, and this is our house, and he's living in my house, and then the people ask the kid, are you okay with this, and he says yes. I mean, there's an issue there. Well, how does the kid know? Because that he was raised and he's only 4. So I think the way the judges might rule is to say, just like if I sign a contract and I'm drunk, I think the courts wouldn't enforce it. And so I think it's the same way. There'd be some notion of, do you have the legal maturity to make a decision like that? And if not, if you're a little kid or if you're an adult but you're drunk or there's a gun pointed at you, we just use the sort of rational, reasonable person standard. And that's the way you could get the community standards of, okay, this is unacceptable child abuse, and you know, say the kid might agree to it, but come on, he doesn't know what he's doing. So I think that's the way legally it would work.
I just wanted to add one more thing. When you mentioned difficult libertarian issues, here's one that I can't solve, and I hope somebody else will help me out on this, a weakness in libertarian theory, and that is animal torture. Taking a cat and putting gasoline on it and lighting a fire and just burning it to death. I mean, to me, that's pretty low. And yet, libertarianism is unable to put that person in jail or use violence against them in some way, which I would like in my heart of hearts. But I can't reconcile that with libertarian theory, because animals, you know, we eat them. So, you know, we have a problem here. So if anyone can think of
you're looking for a thesis or dissertation.
Yes.
Well, I have a solution. Well, Marshall's
solution. I mean, you could partially deal with this by homeowners associations. Like, I mean, there would be people who believe in not torturing animals, and they would be saying, I can't believe I'm stuck in this anarcho-capitalist society, and I'm super rich and everything, but animals are still being tortured. So they'll say, all right, well, then that's it. Not on my city block they won't be, and so that would at least be one way of doing it.
Right there.
Yes.
The question was, Rothbard was optimistic about the prospects for liberty. How do we stand on that? I have two answers to that. First, I reject the question because my actions will not differ by one iota if I am pessimistic or optimistic. I'm having a hell of a lot of fun tweaking noses by promoting liberty. And if I'm an optimist, I'll do the same thing that I'll do if I'm a pessimist, so it really doesn't matter. But since you asked the question, I'll answer the question. I'm a pessimist, at least for the next million years or so, because I'm into sociobiology, and I believe that we're hardwired for explicit cooperation. The caveman who helped the other caveman this week because he was sick, and the next week they reversed it. That tribe lasted. Those are our parents. Great-grandparents, whereas the tribe of cavemen who had the equal brain power and the equal opposable thumb and the equal everything else but didn't have that didn't survive. But we're not hardwired for implicit cooperation, namely markets. When we had Katrina, the aftermath of Katrina, the price of orange juice went up, the price of candles and flashlight batteries, etc., went up. And everyone was saying, well, this is price gouging. Now, we know, because we have some economic sophistication, that this was implicit cooperation. The way to get people to help us in New Orleans, apart from charity, would be to let the price rise, let the profits rise. Then everyone and his uncle comes from Kentucky and God knows where else and brings stuff down, and then the price will come down. But Governor Blanco, you know, said that this was price gouging and everyone was applauding her. There was this case that Michael Munger of Duke tells where there was a line of people, 20, 30 people, and somebody from Tennessee came down with a whole truckload of gallons of water. And ordinarily, a gallon of water is, what, 75 cents. Now he's selling these gallons of water for 25 bucks. So somebody online gets on his cell phone and calls the cops and says that there's somebody gouging us. He's online, which indicates that he values the water more than the 25 bucks. And then the cops come and shut it down and take the water away, and everyone online applauds. Well, what's that? I mean, what that is that we're not hardwired to appreciate free enterprise, and the only way we can relate with millions or billions of people is through the market. So I'm a very short-term pessimist until our hardwiring gets changed, which takes millions of years.
That's pretty pessimistic. Rothbard was, as he always said, he was always pessimistic in the short run, and always optimistic in the long run. Okay, right here.
Do you want other people to answer that? I think he was asking.
I was kind of curious about ACA.
Everybody.
Yeah. Well, just raise your hand if you're an optimist.
He's new.
let somebody else. Let Timothy. Do you have any comment on that?
Maybe I'm the only optimist because I'm the youngest guy here. I haven't lived long enough to realize the problems with my optimism, but I guess I'm still optimistic about the power of persuasion, the power of ideas. I think we have a really good set of ideas here, and I think that as our ideas begin to permeate through society, as I think has been undeniable in the last few decades, as that's happened, I've been very encouraged, and I think that there's a lot of room for hope. But again, I don't think it much matters whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic, because like Professor Block, I'm going to end up doing the same thing anyway.
All right, I just have two sentences. First of all, he's like 5 days younger than me, so what a jerk. But secondly, I don't know if I'm optimistic that, you know, we're going to win, you know, in the next 10 years or something. But the fact is that we even though I believe firmly that in what the Austrian school teaches, and that we're that this stuff is right, and that the completely separate libertarian stuff is right and is good and justifiable, at the same time I realize that we are, you know, we're a fringe group, even though we shouldn't be. The people who are in the mainstream are the fringe, right? They're all crazy, warmongering lunatics, and they're the mainstream, and we who believe in peace are on the so-called fringe. But the fact is that people can reach us now, like never before. And I know it's a cliche, the internet reaches a lot of people, but I mean, really, it is a, like, there will now forever be an anti-central bank party out there that will be on TV talking about its position. That's never happened before. There will forever be an Austrian presence in the national conversation that has never existed before. So that piques curiosities. So that means I think we will grow. We might lose in the long run. Who knows? But certainly our numbers are destined to go up. And we can tap into the natural youthful anti-authoritarian feeling, like, hey man, don't you tell me what to do, man. We can sow out, don't you tell me what to do. Yeah. All right.
I first got into the libertarian or Austro-libertarian movement in 1962, and I met Murray Rothbard in around 1965 or 1966. And at that time, there were probably, in the whole world, 30 Austro-libertarians, and Murray knew them all. And if Murray didn't know them, they weren't Austro-libertarians. Now, there are 30 groups that I've never heard of that are Austro-libertarians. I mean, Ron Paul came to Loyola and got 1,100 people. He comes to some schools and he packs the football field with 17,000 people. When we started the Mises University in 82, 83, I don't know how many... 86 or 87. I'm not a historian. These guys. I don't know how many people we had, but we didn't have anything like 240 people. The web traffic of the Mises is superlative and rising. So there is some case for optimism. Also, if you compare the movement when I started it and now, it's just gigantic and humongous. On the other hand, you know, look at how Ron Paul is treated by most people. In the media, look at what the average New York Times or Washington Post says about things. So there is a case for optimism, there's a case for pessimism, but I think the bottom line is liberty is a wonderful thing. We're going to do what we can for it no matter whether there's a case for optimism or pessimism. So it's an interesting thing, but it doesn't really impact our lives.
Okay, next question.
Well, Atlas Shrugged, one of the books that has perhaps created more libertarians than any other single book that came out in 1957 and still sells 500,000 copies a year, had Galt's Gulch, which was sort of an anarcho-capitalist society, even though Ayn Rand was not an anarcho-libertarian, she was a minarchist. There are many fictional depictions of a free society. And also, look at the world scale. We do not have a world government. China and Portugal are in a state of anarchy with each other. Hong Kong and Australia are in a state of anarchy. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that because the U.S. is becoming a world government. But apart from that, we don't have a world government, so we have anarchy between nations. And very few people are saying we should have a world government. So there is that.
That's not his question, though.
There, yes.
I wanted to ask a question, like a practical question. So, you guys here in America, you have the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Well, how did you got this started? Because in Ecuador, we're like you were when Walter started. We are like 5-6 people, and we all know each other, and we mail each other, but we're not well organized. We all work, and we all have stuff to do, so we can't dedicate all the time to this cause. So, what did you do when you first started? When you were like we are right now? You were, I guess you were kind of lost. Which hints would you
Well, I mean, we're really the wrong persons to ask in the sense that we didn't do it. I mean, we said, you know, teachers, writers, thinkers, whatever. I mean, it's people like Lou Rockwell, for example. Lou is the entrepreneur who got the resources. He raised funds, right? He went knocking on doors. He talked to people who might be interested in providing financial and other support. He recruited speakers and helped to organize, right? I mean, it takes a kind of intellectual entrepreneur who can take a movement and actually give it, you know, the resources that it needs to carry on the work that's necessary. I mean, what I would advise someone like you is to look at history. I mean, that's what the question you're asking. But you could also look at, you know, there are a lot of published histories of other groups that have tried to do these kinds of things, like the Mont Pelerin Society. There are a number of published accounts of how that was done. Now, the Mont Pelerin Society today is very different from kind of what the founding vision was. But you can read, Hayek has given his own account of how he did it. I mean, he wrote letters to people. He made phone calls and tried to get money and arrange for meeting rooms, and he was a real organizer. But again, it takes an entrepreneur organizer to build a movement. Merely having scholars and teachers isn't enough.
In around 1967, I made a trip across the country, and Murray Rothbard gave me the names of people in various cities en route, Chicago, Denver, whatever. And I met them, and they didn't know each other. That was the most appalling thing to me, that they'd never heard of each other, and I was sort of like the Johnny Appleseed. I introduced them to each other. What I would suggest for you in Ecuador, if there are six Ecuadorians, if you all live in the same city, then once a month, get together, have dinner, and have a book club where you read a chapter in Man, Economy, and State, or you read Atlas Shrugged, or something. And then each of you try to get one more person to come to this book club meeting that meets once a month. Start off that way. I think Peter is right. In order to get something like this, this colossus in Auburn, you have to have special talent. But, you know, you're just a kid, say, without any particular entrepreneurial talent. But, you know, you can call your buddies and say, let's get together.
I was just going to say, have you been in touch with the people? I mean, I realize they speak Portuguese, but have you been in touch with the people at Mises Brazil? Okay, but we should put you in touch with them, because now in that case you did have a wealthy entrepreneur behind it, but he knew what he was doing. It's just because you have money doesn't mean you know how to organize something, and he's done a fantastic job. So you should contact him. And your mentor, Juan Fernando Carpio, was down there with us at the Mises Brazil event, so he can also put you in touch with them, and he would have some good ideas.
There's,
I think,
a big libertarian movement in Guatemala as well.
So. Yep. Yeah, that's another good example. That's right.
I was around almost from the very beginning of the Mises Institute, and when it first came to Auburn, it was in literally the where it was an old tool shed where Lou and Jeff were sitting over there by the stadium behind it. It's probably still there somewhere, but it's gone. They knocked it down and built something else, but that was literally it. And then they rented space from the university, and they had just a little suite of a couple of offices. And the first Mises universities, I think we only had like 30 or 40 students, something like that. And our benefactors' summits in the early days, we had the same 25 or so people show up the October conference. Now it'll be packed. This year probably be 250 or so like this. And, you know, we had the last one in Spain, and we had, you know, all these people going all the way to Spain to have to this benefactors conference. And so in the early days of this institute, it wasn't much different than what you're experiencing right now in Ecuador. It was a very small group, you know, Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell and Jeff Tucker, and Ron Paul was involved from the very, very beginning, and a few other people. But in the small group of academics, Tom Woods was still in diapers when this happened. And so it can happen in Ecuador. Lou created this out of nothing.
Alexander?
Just considering what has been said in the past 10 minutes about Atlas Shrugged and your situation in Ecuador, I just see this paradox, or somehow this situation where, this paradoxical situation where in each country, Austrians, or, well, let's call them libertarians, are a fringe group. But in the aggregate,
when you take all of them together, there aren't enough libertarians around to make something possible, something real. I mean, it hasn't. I'm not talking about the real state in the first place, but just something to actually put it in practice.
Okay, I'll take that as just a comment.
Mark, we're getting dangerously close to our time. We have to beat the other group with pizza and beer.
Okay, well, we can adjourn. You guys can talk to us on an individual basis. Thank you very much.